the UK courts aren't worth the paper that they're written on. It has really shocked me how the case, you know, throughout the entire proceeding has really been based on untruths, if not lies, about what Julian is going to be facing. One is that he would not receive 175 years. And they had the audacity early in the proceedings to highlight my case as a benchmark for the type of sentence anyone going up against the Espionage Act would receive. I was facing over 100 years. When the judge gave me 42 months, the prosecutor was absolutely livid. He was wanting far more than that. And that is exactly what Assange is going to face. Any assurances about not receiving a harsh sentence are incredulous. I mean, it's just incredible that they would even make such a claim.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time. Just really appreciate you coming on, sharing your experiences with us and your invaluable insight and knowledge. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I recently published classified documents of the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Spanish courts about the extradition of David Mendoza Herarte. He was also given similar assurances to those of Assange. In fact, he even signed a contract, as we just mentioned before. Assange's lawyers cited Mendoza's case during the High Court hearings in October. In the High Court judgment, the judges say they examined Mendoza's and Abu Hamza's cases and found that, quote, neither provides any evidence of a failure to comply with an assurance, and neither provides any support for Mr. Assange's submission that this court should not regard the offered assurances as reliable. If you look carefully, just before that, they state that, quote, both can be said to show that the USA may be expected to apply the strict letter of an assurance which it has given. They're basically admitting that US assurances are so vague, the US can get around them without really breaking them, and that is the whole problem. Now, when I read this, I'm frankly astounded. It sounds to me like the judges only read the verbal note, the diplomatic note, sent by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid in January 2009. But that is just one assurance in Mendoza's case. Now, diplomatic assurances can come in many forms, and Mendoza did receive another. He had a contract called the Acta de Entrega, or Deed of Surrender. This contract, this diplomatic assurance, was signed by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, by the Spanish government and Mendoza himself. And it clearly stipulates that Mendoza must be sent back to Spain to serve his sentence. He cannot be given a life sentence and so on. Did the High Court judges in England see this contract at all? Because if the initial verbal note was vague, well, this document certainly isn't. The Acta de Entrega is a very crystal clear contract and a diplomatic assurance that the United States violated without a doubt. They blocked Mendoza's transfer to Spain three times and kept him in the U.S. for almost 7 years. This is all in the documents that I published. Now, I can tell you that these documents were never shown or cited in any of the Assange court proceedings as of yet, which makes me wonder, did the judges even get a chance to examine them at all? How can they arrive to such a conclusion after looking at Mendoza's case? Because if they're missing all these documents, it's simply impossible to understand what happened. The High Court's decision to allow Assange's extradition to the United States is extremely disturbing on several fronts. Instead of pointing out that this indictment criminalizes national security journalism, the corporate media, the mainstream media, are just joking around and gloating at the prospect of someone going to prison for the rest of their lives. For what? For doing their job as a journalist, which is something the people at MSNBC and CNN and the BBC know nothing about. Now, the High Court accepted that Assange is suicidal, that the extradition would be oppressive, but they also decided to trust the United States. They trust the U.S. to treat him well, And I must say I'm shocked at this ruling. I don't understand how they could come to such a conclusion, especially after they say they looked at other extraditions like Mendoza's. Now, Assange's legal team have 14 days from the decision to request an appeal at the Supreme Court. Stella Morris, who is Assange's partner and also on the legal team, has confirmed that they will be doing this. When Assange is in court, they're not discussing press freedoms anymore. They've already criminalized that. And right now, they're discussing how he's going to be treated in U.S. custody and whether he'll kill himself because of how bad the prison conditions are. They're discussing whether these diplomatic assurances can be trusted. The answer is no. And that's what people must fight to highlight right now. That's why right now Mendoza's case is more important than ever, because it exposes how the United States and its promises cannot be trusted. I can tell you, the documents that I published were never mentioned as of yet in the courtroom during Assange's extradition proceedings. So whether the high court judges have actually seen these documents, I don't know. But if they did see these documents, if they did see how the U.S. broke its assurances every single day for almost 7 years when it kept Mendoza in the U.S. and denied his transfer application 3 times, then I simply don't understand how they came to the conclusion that they can trust assurances for Assange, because they are terribly, terribly mistaken, and time is running out. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a genuine pleasure and an absolute honor to be with you guys and to have a share in your precious and valuable time. And I am ever so grateful that you guys take time out of your day to hopefully join in our little discussions that we have. I don't necessarily consider myself as a creative person. I don't know whether it's because of my anxiety that I constantly am in a state of brain fog, or because I haven't dabbled in enough things that demand any degree of creativity in general. But I do understand that in life, you need to be creative. Sometimes you need to be impulsive. Sometimes you need to be spontaneous. Sometimes you need to be innovative. You need to think outside of the box. You need to do something out of character, get out of your comfort zone and stuff like that. It might sound cliche, but it is necessary. It's necessary for our growth, because there's like, well, some people are born creative. My brother was born creative, God bless him. And some aren't very much, right? But it's definitely something that we can train ourselves to achieve. You know? Human beings can do anything they set their mind to. I bet if we really set our mind to it, we could grow an extra limb. But no one's really wanted to do that before, I think. But the point is that some people are born creative and they lead pretty creative minds, pretty creative lives. And by creative, I mean almost every corner of their lives possesses an element that sets their soul on fire. Otherwise, they cannot continue, right? And then some people aren't necessarily born that creative. Everyone has a certain degree of creativity, but they're not like genius creative. And it can be developed. Let's hear a short story. You know what? Let's do that so we can get a better idea of what we mean by creativity. And we're going to be right back.
Mm-hmm.
man was exploring caves by a seashore when he found a bag with a bunch of hardened clay balls. The balls looked like someone had intentionally rolled the clay and left them out in the sun to bake. Perhaps some children made them while they were at the beach, the man thought. They didn't look much, so he took the bag out of the cave with him. As he strolled along the beach, he threw the clay balls one by one out to the oceans as far as he could. The clay balls would fly and disappear in the ocean. The man threw several clay balls in the ocean until he dropped one of the balls and it cracked open. Inside the clay was a beautiful, precious stone. This excited the man and he started breaking the remaining clay balls. Each of it contained different types of precious stones. He found thousands of dollars worth of jewels in around 20 clay balls that was left with him. He had been on the beach for a long time and he must have thrown away many clay balls with hidden treasure into the sea. He could have had a treasure worth of tens of thousands rather than just thousands if he had not thrown the clay balls away. Most of the time we look at someone or even ourselves and we see the external clay vessel. The vessel doesn't always look sparkly and nice, so we never bother to look inside it. We tend to see and judge a person and deem them as less important than the ones who are more beautiful, stylish, well-known, or wealthy. We forget to look inside for the unique treasure that each one of us holds. May we not come to the end of our lives and realize that we have thrown away a fortune in friendship, love, or any relationship because we did not attempt to look for the gems hidden in bits of clay. Let us all relish the treasures each of us hold inside us.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Just being creative in life, in finding solutions, being able to think outside the box when we are stuck in a box. What being able to look beyond the curb, look beyond that dead end, beyond that wall, it requires creativity. Being able to trust in God and rely on what He has for you tomorrow is thinking outside of the box and being creative. And oftentimes I found that that is the best solution to all my problems. It doesn't mean that I will just sit in the box and do nothing and, you know, wait for God to come around with a box cutter and crack the little sucker open and release me. No, that's not what it means. It means that once I rely on God, once I choose this route of creativity, I will be given the strength to even gnaw my way out of this box if I have to, because I know Allah has something good in store for me outside of it. By hook or by crook, I'm going to make it through this moment because I know God's got my back. That's a form of creativity, I think. And perhaps the best form, to know that my Creator is the creator of all things, even creativity itself, and that He will create a way, He will find a way, He will make a path. Another way to develop this sense of creativity in our lives is being more mindful of the situations we have, we're in, and the opportunities we have, and not just, you know, passing them by all indifferent and passive and nonchalant,
being mindful of the situations. Because once we're mindful, we increase the level of our awareness. We connect with the elements and the situations around us better. And then we are more able to soak in that moment and analyze each factor as it is. And once we do that, we gain knowledge about it. Once we gain knowledge, we can make better decisions, and that, you know, enters creativity. So practicing mindfulness, practicing the art of living in the moment, of being in the now, so you can make a proper decision for the now. If I am in the now, but I'm constantly thinking about the tomorrow or the past, I won't be able to understand the now well enough to collect information and data for it to use in a creative manner in the future. Being mindful, practicing mindfulness, heartfulness, gratitude for the moment I'm in right now, really being still in the presence, is a way for us to develop creativity and just appreciate life in general. Sort of like how artists live their lives, you know? Or photographers, have you seen? A photographer and an artist, every moment they're just looking for little details around themselves to capture, to savor, to save in their memory, to help them through the unknown of tomorrow. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. His
really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are mostly based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet, and naturally of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, we'll be continuing our discussion on how to raise teenagers in an Islamic fashion. We said last time that we should know when we want to teach them something, educate them, or maybe even discipline them, that we should do so in a spontaneous manner. It should not be too overly scripted so as to bore them, but should be done in a natural and conversational manner. In addition to that, we also said that when speaking to them, we should employ pathos and logos, both emotion and logic, because only through a mix of both can we actually reach and get our point across to our teenage children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammadin wa ajjal farajuhum. Because we said it is a sensitive time for children crossing into teenage years, so as parents, the way we approach our kids, the way we speak to our kids, the way that we deal with our kids obviously has to change as well.
Right.
As far as they're going through a phase of change, they themselves, me and you, we have to go through that phase with them as well.
Right.
One of the things that most parents don't seem to do is to educate their kids about that period itself, being an adult or hitting puberty.
Right.
Where the child, as he turns into a mature, Islamically mature, reaches the age of maturity, he can see changes in his body, he can see changes in his behavior, he can see changes in his mentality, in his emotions towards things around him.
Right.
And 99% of the times, he has no idea what's happening, right? So he's just an explorer.
And an explorer parents, trying to blend in, I might add.
Well, not blend in, but he's trying to pretty much find out what's going on, where am I? He's like Indiana Jones in the middle of a pyramid.
So I don't know, I was confused a lot. I was trying to go with the flow.
Yeah, so he's in a maze, right? And a lot of parents, sadly, they don't explain that period to their kids. Obviously, I don't know, either out of fear, out of embarrassment,
or neglect,
out of ignorance. I don't know. Oh, neglect, like you said. Neglect is ignorance.
Because they're grown up, they're adults now. They should know a lot of things suddenly.
So in a way or another, it is quite sad to see that happen. So first and foremost, we need to educate them about this period.
And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to raise our teenagers in an Islamic fashion. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
We are at a stage where we said we need to explain to our kids the period they are in. And in this period that the kids go in, especially through puberty, they need to understand their halal and their haram.
Of course.
Which is also a sensitive issue. Kids go through a lot of emotional problems and emotional issues or things they bury inside, and they don't expect the parents to understand.
Of course.
Okay? And they have needs that needs to be explained to them as well. They need to be put in the direction.
Right.
Amongst of which their sexuality, which goes haywire at this age.
It's absolutely a monster. You cannot even tame it. Some say you can tame it, but...
So Islam, obviously Islam has a solution for it.
Right, yeah.
But the idea is that the parents need to put the child in the right mindset. Most people, for example, who grow old without being married or not wanting to get married is because at this age, they were not taught the proper ideology and the proper...
The way to approach marriage. This matter as well.
Yeah, so what they learn is they learn what they see on TV, what they see on the media. That
from the culture they live in.
Just have a girlfriend, for example, or a boyfriend, and that's it. Why get married?
It's very normal to have this thought. Very, very normal. Yeah, it's very prevalent among teenagers.
Exactly. So unless we sit them down, we explain to them how this period works and how to navigate it and how to get through it, and how to manage it and give them that guidance ourselves, it will be, a problem because they will be rebellious, they will be constantly arguing, they would never do what you want them to do, and, they will be, wasting time most of the time, and they have nothing else to do. So I've heard so many complaints from parents about their kids, and when I ask them the basic questions about whether they have any sort of interaction or they explain things to them, they're like, no, we haven't. And then they're like, okay, then you should come and talk to them. I'm like, no, I can help from here and there.
But I can guide.
But ultimately, it's your job as a parent to explain this to your kids because, he takes you as an authority, not me.
Right, yeah.
So, for example, if I have to talk to him about marriage, I mean, at the end of the day, I might convince him that marriage for him at a younger age is an excellent thing for him to do, which I always do with teenagers. I convince them that marriage is the best thing, and they're like, that's exactly what I was thinking. But it's like, but say it, my parents would never agree.
And that's the problem.
So they constantly, so the parent needs to come themselves.
They need to educate themselves firstly.
Yeah, and say to their kids, okay, this is what you're going through, this is the halal way, this is the haram way, this is what has to be done, and so on and so forth.
Right.
Otherwise, we're going to have
a problem. Because this is a very... I might say toxic, but at least it is a very sensitive subject, and it is often not spoken about in our communities at all.
Well, I mean, it's not toxic.
Well, not toxic in that manner, but it can spiral in a,
Now, look, there are matters in life that we need to face head to head.
Right.
But it's the approach that makes a difference.
Right.
Okay, so some people approach it differently. Like in the wrong manner, and some people approach it correctly. So
it's a volatile subject. There we have it. Yeah. That's the word.
So you need to obviously approach it correctly.
Right. And with that said, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Well, Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are talking about how to raise our teenagers in an Islamic manner. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us even further.
Now we also have to keep in mind that when we are dealing with teenagers, that we need to teach them not only about the period they're in, but also prepare them for it. They have to be prepared for what's to come and explain, like I said, things to them. So we need to teach them to think and contemplate and think of consequences, because at this age, they haven't had a prior experience in life.
So this is a general rule, not just about Islamic laws.
No. So just general rule. I mean, all these general rules that we have, obviously, is derived from Islam.
Right,
so, for example, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "إذا هممت بأمر فدبر عاقبته."
Right.
If you want to do something, if إن كان خيرا فأقدم.
The Quran is filled about contemplation.
If not, don't. Right. So there is, you know. So this is all Islamic teachings, basically,
right.
But we're just putting it in simple words. So we need to teach the kid to think and contemplate before he does any action or before they act, okay? Because at this stage, like I said, they themselves do not have prior experience.
Right. No life experience.
So they have no experience at all. They don't know what to do when certain things happen.
Of course.
And now it's my job, a new job, to teach them.
Right.
Make them think for themselves, make them more, they use their insight and use their intellect and be able to contemplate on things themselves.
It's basically a rule of life.
Yeah, so it's not, even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, when you see in the Quran, when he constantly talks about the stories of other nations or the Aqwam before us.
Right.
Well, obviously, he's not trying to entertain me and you with this story.
No.
I mean, some of them
not
are
just
quite
a story time.
Yes, some of them are quite entertaining in their nature, but the idea was that Allah's trying to teach you something that you should learn from the people who were before you, what they did and the consequences.
Reflect upon their actions.
And you should not do the same at all.
Right.
Same thing with our kids. So you sit them down. I've seen this happen many times with parents. They bore their kids to death. When I was your age, I had this and I done this.
To be fair, some stories can be very interesting. But
No, the story is one thing, but if you're using it as a method of trying to teach your child, just by reflecting on your past and that's it. I mean, I've heard many times the kids, we've heard this so many times, my dad always said this. He always says, when I was young, I did this. Me, myself, I heard this from my dad all the time. When I was at this age, I used to read this bunch book, and they used to because you had no TV, you had nothing else to do.
It was always,
So that's not the way to get them to think and contemplate and think of their consequences. So we have to train them, basically, into the correct, right method of thinking, the correct and right method of having an insight into things, and the correct method of trying to contemplate on matters. For example, when I talk to kids, I throw in a line or two and I leave it unanswerable, and they're like, okay, so I'm like, what do you think?
Right.
So he automatically starts to
You engage the thinking.
Yeah.
Right.
So he has to do the thinking for himself. So this is what we need to do as well.
Right. And with that, we will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any comments or questions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. In addition to that, we also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Thank you.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable, because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable, unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. The countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard. 1929, Black Tuesday. The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
we'll revive and we'll prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S., as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended, and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others? I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. the secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's overissuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding. And that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly. It makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the U.K. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the U.S. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back? Or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline, and as history has proven to previous empires,